Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. Just a shout out, if Lou, NY2H, is out there, or anyone in charge of the IRLP, the node appears to be down tonight. So if someone knows how to contact Lou or someone who's in charge of the IRLP, I think it needs to be rebooted. That in mind, let me begin. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. This technical net's been going on since 1982, and it continues every Sunday night at 8 p.m. here on the Limark repeater WV2L. As always, I like to remind people that if you can't contact us directly via the radio or IRLP or Echolink, you can email us. So if you have any questions that you'd like to ask, we used to use the mailbag a lot, not so much anymore. If you have any topics you want us to cover, or puzzles you want us to share with the audience, or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some video or website or news item related to NASA and space, the email address that you can contact me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. I will post interesting links somewhat usually related to stories that are covered during the next 3 hours here on the Technical Net, but others that I think are interesting. There's a nice article that I put a link up to that has some illustrations of space and meteors and such that I think people might enjoy reading. And you can get to that link page by just typing into your browser roy.ac2gs.com. We have a chat room. You can either go through the club's website, or you can just type in chat.ac2gs.com, and it'll take you to the chat room. And as always, I am streaming this on the Internet, so any friends or people you know that can't access the usual streams of IRLP or Echolink or radio, they just have to type in technet.ac2gs.com, and that will give them an audio stream of the signal as it comes from my shack. And I always like to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, maintains a archive of all the technets that go as far back as September of 2006. He has that on his website, which is amateurradio.tv. Let me drop for a sec. Okay. Last week I mentioned, unfortunately, due to a high wind storm in August, I lost almost all of my antennas. Thankfully, I still had a Comet GP3 that I'm using right now and use for technical nets and other things on UHF VHF, but all my other antennas are down. And Andy, WA2CDL, and a great guy, Tony, W2ASC, offered to help come by sometime, some weekend, and get up on a 40-foot ladder and help me put back the stuff that's supposed to be on my roof. What happened is a extendable Rhone pole mast bent over. So I have a replacement that has to be inserted, and there's a little bit of tuning up of a 5/8 wave impedance matching circuit that apparently opened up. And we could really use some help. I mentioned last week that we need one or two people agile enough to go up a ladder. Unfortunately, it's a 40-foot ladder to get to my roof. And I didn't get any reply last week, so we're trying again this week. Please, I could really use one or two people's help if they think, if you can go to Brooklyn and climb a ladder and you're willing to help a fellow ham. Contact Andy, WA2CDL, because he's kind of the manager for this little feat of magic. So once again, I would really, really appreciate one or two people's help in addition to Andy and Tony. Let me drop. That said, I will tell you what the plans are for tonight's technical net. Andy, WA2CDL, will not be able to do Andy's corner tonight. We're going to just ask, as we always do, for any questions or topics. Anyone interested in offering a question or make a comment or bring up a topic, I'm going to ask them to tell me their first name and their call sign. We will go into the night trying to answer these questions all together now, and hopefully there'll be enough to fill the space. If not, I have a bunch of science news articles that I can discuss. And approximately at 10:15, Paul will come on and give you the SpaceNet report. So that's the plan for tonight. Anyone interested in offering a question or a topic or a comment for the TechNet tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign.
Les K2TGW.
Less recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list tonight? Okay. Hopefully there'll be other people later on. Les, what's your question or comment tonight?
Okay, it's a theoretical question, but maybe not. I have the ability to hook one of my random wires to my gutter channel that goes all the way around the house. In the wintertime, it does fill up with ice and snow. Is that going to drastically change the SWR or possibly even short things out or make things so bad that an antenna tuner cannot bring it down to something I could use? I will do it anyway, but I'm just wondering how bad or if it's really ineffectual. But we all know water is a good conductor of electricity. Not the best, but still do. Back to you, Roy, K2TGW.
Okay, very good, Les. Well, yeah, as you mentioned, actually, pure distilled water is not a great conductor, but thankfully, in the metropolitan area, most of the water that lands is not very clean. So, yeah, the dirty water that gets down to us usually has all kinds of interesting things dissolved in it and has a relatively low resistance. So you don't have to worry too much that it's a dielectric of some kind. The problem with operating these common household things on the roof as an antenna is you're never quite sure or what kind of resonance or close to resonance you'll get. Also, what's very important is how well the conductors between the different gutter elements are merged together. So, in other words, if you have a good conduction between the different segments, that's far better than just a letting corrosion kind of set in. And when the gutters fill in with water, or one of the things that happens is the metal tends to corrode somewhat, depending upon the salt content in your environment. So, as you mentioned, it's a theoretical question because it's impossible offhand, even with the dimensions, which I doubt we're going to get, what kind of nominal impedance you're going to have to match. It sort of depends upon that and how that changes over time. As the weather changes, you're going to have also expansion and contraction between the gutter joints. So that might cause insertion loss. So it'll be an interesting experiment. People have done it before. There's a lot of complicating problems with it just because of most people don't solder their sections of gutter together to make for a good a low insertion loss.
I guess also what you're saying, it comes to the wind, they might connect and not connect so well? Active.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, in addition to just the geometry and the weather, what's very important is the mechanical status of the different gutter segments. If they're fit tightly together. If someone has actually done a little either welding or soldering or somehow electronically connecting the different segments, you'll have a lot less variation than if it's possibly rattling in the wind as well. So there's a lot of ways it could go terribly wrong. It may not. You may luck out. The only time will tell. But again, people have used this and effectively, but I've also known people who've used this less effectively.
Question, N1YDY?
Yes, Hank.
What are these gutters made out of? Are they aluminum or copper?
Aluminum.
Okay. It's very hard to make that work. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I would agree. The problem, copper, you could make a nice contact. You can actually solder the copper pieces together. Aluminum doesn't really solder, and aluminum is a great metal because it protects itself by oxidizing a very thin non-conducting oxide layer on the very surface of it. That's kind of iffy. So yeah, as Hank indicated, copper gutters would probably have less insertion loss problems.
One other suggestion.
Yeah, sure, Hank.
There's a product called LumiWeld. It's marketed under various other names, but it's a form of aluminum solder that's available. And if you can spend the time to actually solder the... I think they call it braze, but it's truly a solder. Solder the aluminum sections together, then you don't have to deal with the self-oxidation on the aluminum joint. But it's a time-consuming and it requires a bit of finesse.
That's a good idea. I mean, there is a cheaper, quicker, dirtier method. They do make this interesting material. I've seen it, I think, in DX Engineering. I may actually have a bottle of it someplace in the shack for fitting together aluminum elements. I think it's basically some kind of oil suspension with small particles of metal in them. The idea that it improves the conductivity between elements that are slid together. So depending upon exactly how the gutters are abutted to each other, that might be an option. I've never really heard of anyone using them for gutters. They're usually used for masts and such, but that's also an option of a kind.
I don't think it's going to happen. I would have, 300 feet or more. It's a long house. It goes on three sides of the houses. I bet it's close to 400 feet. And if you think anybody's going to go up there and solder all those joints together, it's not worth it. Better off laying a piece of wire someplace.
I would agree. I mean, if you just want to play experiment and just run some transmission line and have it as a ongoing experiment, it might be interesting. I think that you're safer, easier, and much more trouble-free by just running the standard piece of wire. You don't have to worry about insertion losses. You don't have to worry about corrosion. It's just makes life much simpler. All things considered.
Okay, then I'll just stick with the long wire I have, and I won't connect one side to the gutter. Although I might just try just for the experiment. Might be interesting. But as you say, it might not be the same thing every day or every 10 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, part of this hobby is experimentation. Some people prefer tinkering and building to talking and tuning. So if that's if you're curious about that, you bring a little bit more information to the hobby, you learn a little bit about how things work, and you can come back here and share it with us.
Okay, I will try it. The next couple of days are supposed to be warm, so somehow took a, take a piece of a bell wire and connect it in and see what happens. I'm also curious. I don't think it's going to blow anything out, so the curiosity sometimes kills the cat, but I don't think it's going to break anything.
Yeah, I would suggest not throwing your linear amplifier if you have one on this experiment, but I think it's worth something. Do you perchance have a VNA? VNAs are really dropping in price. I just placed an order for a nano VNA version 2 that goes up to 3 gigahertz for something like $80. But if you have a VNA, it might be interesting to just kind of see where the impedance goes.
Well, we'll experiment. The simple part is just hooking it up, attaching it to the leaders and gutters and see what happens. I think I did it once, but the wire broke off in a windstorm, so I know your feelings. I also have a couple of antennas down, but I haven't. Enough up there that I still can play. All right, thank you, Roy. I will report back in most likely next weekend.
Okay, very good, Les. I wish you good luck, and I look forward to hearing the results of this experiment. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limemark Technical Net. So if you have any questions or comments or observations or topics you would like to roll around tonight of a technical nature, please give me your first name and your call sign.
Hey, Roy, Hank again. I got one more comment about gutters.
Yeah, sure, Hank.
So I tried using stainless steel as a jumper between sections in an aluminum gutter house that I had years ago, and I found that while when I first put it up, it was pretty resistant to wind vibration and things of that nature, even water, heavy rain and stuff like that. What did finally happen is a couple years later, the sections where I used the sheets metal screw had corroded enough that I wasn't getting good connection.
Yeah, I mean that's the problem with these types of, you know, if you don't have a good electrical contact. Some of the worst stories I've ever heard were brilliant guys who decided that they were going to use chicken wire as a ground plane rather than simple radials. And the problem with that, obviously, as time goes on, the interconnects between the chicken wire pick up a degree of corrosion. All those little points are basically nonlinear devices, and they act as mixers for any kind of RF that touches them and wreaks havoc on an antenna system. So corrosion not only can produce insertion losses, but can produce nonlinear devices generating harmonics all over the darn place. So I can certainly understand that.
I have to agree. I saw a gentleman once who used expanded metal. I believe you know what this is. It's a type of perforated metal where they make the perforations and they pull on it and it creates the effect of something like chicken wire, but it's made out of one piece. And they had stucco, that's not the word, the stuff you put in your house, this on the side of the house, and he still managed to get corrosion at the point where he had connected his ground to this. So this worked great for a couple of years, but he couldn't get the stucco off, or stucco, come on, I'm drawing a blank on that, off of the house to reconnect the wire.
Yeah, I think the word you're looking for is stucco.
Yes, I am. I don't know why I couldn't come up with it.
Nah, it's perfectly fine, Hank. I lately have had this problem between the word winch and cinch. You know, brains work in interesting ways.
Oh, I have to comment on that. So I used to live on a boat, as I think you knew, and there's a word wench and a word winch, and I, of course, used the wrong one at one time and managed to offend a guest.
Okay, that's a good one. Yeah. It just, you know, when I just used the word cinch, the other person was just confused. But, yeah, I could see where wench would get into trouble. It's an interesting thing. In regular conversation, usually these days, wench is not used, at least in the company that I'm aware of.
Yep, I can't argue with that. All right, thanks for letting me come back with my comments in one whitey way.
You're welcome, Hank. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. It works best when people bring up a subject or ask a question or make a comment. So please, if anyone out there has anything that they'd like to roll around, you know, discuss something about antenna design, discuss something about radios, discuss, you know, new devices, hotspots, software-defined radios, all kinds of fun things out there. The joys of FT8. Still a lot of people are wallpapering their walls with distant communications using FT8 because of the magic of low symbol rate and highly redundant error correction. So if anyone out there wants to bring up any of these subjects or others, please feel free. Give me your first name and your call sign.
K2GJE, over.
Yes, Ed. What can I do you for today?
Good evening. I know this repeater and many other Long Island repeaters broadcast radio amateur newsline. Is or is that not broadcasting? And I thought we're not allowed to do that. Over.
Okay, that is a very good question, Ed. Most of your questions or topics are good. I might be wrong, but I think the ARRL started these kind of news programs so that you have two pre-recorded news sources, the one that our club uses, and the ARRL also provides a audio version of the weekly ARRL letter. And I think they actually got special dispensation from the FCC to get around that concept of it being a broadcast. So as far as I'm aware, the FCC has given their blessing to both entities to package pre-recorded news that can be played along with other activities like InfoNet, as long as you take the pause to ID the repeater every 10 minutes.
Okay, I'll accept that answer. I know there was a gentleman that was trying to broadcast information for amateurs, and I think even code practice. They did not get him on broadcasting. He was shut down because the station was running, I guess, from a tape recorder without his presence to control it. Over.
Okay, I mean, that's definitely a no-no. It you know, by pretty much FCC rules, there has to be a control operator at all times in these situations. But I think that their general tendency is they really don't like broadcasting. ARRL apparently got away with a bunch of things because, as you certainly know, the ARRL does issue transmissions, really broadcasts, on the amateur bands. They do the Morse code practice. They do announcements of events and such. So they're kind of, you know, on the line. It's really, to me, it's broadcast, but I could understand why some minor level of broadcasting is acceptable. If you or I were to start playing music and acting like we were FM radio jockeys, most likely, if the FCC cared enough, they would shut us down immediately. But, you know, if you edge towards the letter of the law and you don't kind of jump over it too much, I guess they let places like the ARRL and the other agency that makes the other Newsline audio feed work. Well, once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. So, we got an interesting amount of time to fill. If you have any questions of a technical nature, I kind of ran down a whole bunch of relatively new aspects of amateur radio from the last 10 years. If anyone's curious or they haven't really gotten into it yet and want to discuss it, feel free to do it here. Just as a minor aside, for those people who like hotspots, a lot of them are Pi stars, and they use Raspberry Pi. And just the other week, Raspberry Pi has released a new design. They call it the Raspberry Pi 400. In case you want to get your feet wet with using something like a microcomputer Raspberry Pi, it's basically built into a keyboard, so you don't have to worry about a case. You basically just plug a USB power source into it. You can plug a mouse on the USB, and you can plug it into either a TV or a computer monitor, and you have a little Raspberry Pi full function almost computer. For the keyboard alone costs $70, I'm told, and for $100 they throw in a mouse, a power supply, and a starter book. That's full of things that you could use to do things on the Raspberry Pi. So once again, if anyone wants to talk about either any of these subjects I brought up or other subjects I didn't, please feel free.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
I did a quick Google on this QSTs, and apparently it is addressed in the regulation, section 97.3, subpart B, defines an information bulletin. And an information bulletin has to contain subject matter that is of direct interest to the amateur service. And, of course, it has to be controlled, but it's not prohibited. Broadcasting is prohibited, except for emergency communication. But apparently there's a cutout for something named information bulletin and of direct interest to the amateur service.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Lou. It'd be interesting historically. Again, I'm not quite sure which started. The online news, the gentleman passed away about 5-6 years ago. I think he started off in around New York, and he moved to California, and he passed away, and other people took up the cudgel for him there. So I don't know if the ARRL kind of took the idea from him or he took the idea from the ARRL, but I'm sure it's somewhere in the midst of an Internet search.
UWR with a question.
Yes, WR.
I'm kind of new to ham radio. I've been doing a lot of hiking and wanted to start using a HD, analog HD, to connect ATRS IS to send the SNS where no cell phone coverage is possible. I've got that working locally, and I was curious. I see a lot of repeaters and repeater books that have IRLP Echo Link D-Star where ATRS coverage is not available. Are there any other means to do kind of the same thing without ATRS?
Okay, that's an interesting question. Anyone out there familiar with this? I pretty much thought it was a kind of a segmented situation, unfortunately, but I might be wrong.
KD2AMZ, I didn't hear the question. Could you repeat it, please?
Yeah, I'm looking to do a similar function as ATRS-IS, where you can send with an HD, analog HD cable to a cell phone, send an SMS, out over the air to the SMS network. I'm looking to do something similar where there is no ATRS coverage, but I know there are routers that have, IRLP, Uplink, C-Star, and other modes. Just wondering, is anything like that possible?
Well, I do QRP work and I go hiking. Why don't you just get a QRP rig like a KX3 or a KX2 and just go out there and you could do PSK31 or any digital mode like that you can choose. Remember, a cell phone is not amateur radio.
I understand what you're saying, Mike, but, we're trying to answer the gentleman's question as best we can. He would like to be able to find a gateway, apparently, to send SMS messages to cell phones, which is as good as any idea technologically. My understanding is that no such bridge exists presently. If it is, it's very experimental, and I haven't read about it. It's very common for Echolink connections. It's very common for IRLP. Those have been around for over 15 plus years. APRS is sort of getting into a lot of digital radio technology, DMR and the other digital technology. It's just that, as I mentioned, I am unaware that there is any repeaters that are working on gateways for SMS signaling. I could be wrong, and I kind of threw it out to the audience if anyone out there heard anything about some guys tinkering, because there's always a guy tinkering someplace.
To the best of my knowledge, there is none. If you're in an area way out of reach, you only got HF. Then, of course, you might bounce a signal off a satellite, but that's only for a few minutes. If you want to send an SMS text, PSK31, and then someone's just going to have to relay it. But there really is no internet connection in the middle of nowhere.
Well, no, I agree with you. There's not going to be a cell phone type of connection to make life easy. I think the gentleman was sort of asking if, because some people plant repeaters in all kinds of interesting places. So I think one of the things he was trying to get a feel for is if there are any repeater sites in the United States that are either working on or have figured out a means to offer that type of a gateway. As you mentioned, and I agree, I know of no one even working on that yet. I mean, you might Google it. There might be someone burning the midnight oil just tonight working on something like that. But as far as I'm aware, there's nothing published out there that anyone that I know is talking about.
Agreed. There's nothing out there. Again, SATCOM, but that's military. But for the amateur, the old-fashioned HF. Like I said, if you're new, great, wonderful. PSK31 if you want to send text messaging. And then, of course, hey, how about good old-fashioned code? That always works.
Well, if there's a guy on the other end, yes, but if you want to actually communicate with SMS, usually probably the guy on the other end is operating a cell phone. I don't know if Morse code is going to really help, you know, getting sent to him. But, you know, there are other options, as Mike mentioned. You might want to look into it. I would certainly, I'm sure I'm basically telling you what you already know, that you should take a Google search and look to see if there's any forum of any experimental gateway. It might not be available in this area, but at least you might learn something about it and be a little bit more aware if someone uses that type of technology in a location that's accessible to you.
Okay, thank you. KDC-UWR, and back to now.
Okay, very good. Thanks for participating tonight. Once again, this is still AC2GS, and I'm still called Roy, and this is still called the Limewire Technical Net. So once again, if anyone has any comments or questions or topics or anything that they would like to discuss of a technical nature, please give me your first name and your call sign.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
So a quick check with Uncle Google tells me that there's something launched in 2014 called SMS-GTE, which allows amateur radio operators to exchange text messages between their APRS radios or clients and the SMS cellular text messages system. So I guess it's out there.
Okay, thank you very much. So SMS-GTE. Which I assume is either some fancy acronym or just leaving out a couple of a single letter for gate, as in gateway. But what would be sort of interesting, if KD2AWR Googles it, take a look and see what the locations are, what repeater sites, what percentage of repeater sites and any in this area that are using this type of technology. It's news to me, but I'm not a big SMS guy, so I could understand why I might have missed it. But thank you, Lou, and I hope KD2AWR looks, do a Google search for MSS-GTE, apparently.
It also looks like DMR has the capability.
God, that's interesting. Is that straight out of the box, or is that related to the network that links into it?
Very quickly, I'm looking at the Boca Raton Amateur Radio Association, and they are mentioning Grandmaster, so I'd have to dig in further to find out, but seems like it's all out there.
Okay, very good, Lou. So KD2AWR, as I always tell people, Google is your friend. Take a look around, see what's there. If they've developed those type of links to Brandmeister, you can get a DMR radio. They're not terribly expensive. A lot of them made in China. As long as you have a code plug for them, that's always the secret. Either do it yourself or more likely find someone who already invented the wheel and look into this aspect of DMR. I know DMR does APRS, so I gather that someone was kind enough to figure out a gateway to link the packets of APRS to SMS internet signals, packets, and such. So that's interesting. I got to look that up and read a bit on it.
All right, Ian Whitechurch, and I think the fellow you were thinking of before was Bill Pasternak.
Yeah. He was, I remember when he passed away, and there was a little bit of a concern of, would they find people to kind of take his place, because he was kind of the guy for that news. And thankfully, among other people, there was a woman on Long Island who works for a local newspaper that became involved, and a group of people are continuing his legacy, which is nice to see. Okay, once again, AC2GS, Roy, Limark TechNet. If you have any questions of a technical nature any comments or topics, if you want to talk about science, if you want to talk about chemistry, physics, geology, medicine, if you want to discuss the COVID-19 virus, any questions open, just give me your first name and your call sign. Yes, Wesley.
I thought I got prepared for the discussion, but I sent you a few links about magnetometers and different kind of magnetometers. Did you have time to go through it?
I went through some of them. A proton magnetometer, as you mentioned, it really is a Earth magnetic field magnetometer. I don't think it's quite used as much as it once was. There are different technologies that have superseded it for geological phenomena in the last 10-plus years because of the speed that it can do a scan and a smaller size and lower power requirements, something along those lines.
I might have a different opinion. we talk about protons in the very uncomplicated atoms to be aligned, and then disalign a base, so we create a magnetic field for aligning the protons. Hydrogen, I believe that was, and then we rapidly switch it to the Earth magnetic field, and then we see the variation. By that, we could actually see on the land and underwater the structures, and they don't have to be ferrous. They don't have to be magnetic. Let me go. Archaeology is one of the applications, searching for buried foundations and walls. And it could be also used much for mineral exploration and oil and gas exploration. It is also used for military application. It was once when I was trying to implement different method that was a very existing vibration of the earth sensed by piezo foil, and it was for the project for NASA. And it was I came to the conclusion that I could build a bomb, and the bomb doesn't blow. I mean, it blows but doesn't kill. It just spreads to thousands of pieces, and each of the sensors could measure the underground strata to the depth of 2 kilometers at that time. Although that technology had nothing to do with magnetic field, I got a big risk back to the method that could use the magnetic field or the method that could see beneath the ground. And that's what is happening here. So I see that very much interesting, especially proton magnetometer. And there was a number of videos that I sent you when you see a guy walking with the device, but those things could be also lifted by a drone. And drone could actually look at what's going to be in the ground. So we're not only talking about the metal or a depository, not necessarily that has to be iron, but the metal or depository, and based on its magnetic properties, whether this is paramagnetic or it's a magnetic. Back to you.
Yeah, that's the principle of these proton magnetometers. But like I said, as far as, and I'm certainly not an expert in this in the slightest, but it's my understanding that there are two variations that have been found to be much more effective. One's called the Overhauser magnetometer due to using the Overhauser effect, which just means that rather than using hydrogen-rich things like kerosene and such, they're using stuff that have radicals in them. And another technology that uses cesium as a substrate, it can handle much higher sensitivities. So although I agree with you, the technology is there, it's interesting, I think in general people who use these types of magnetometers have kind of moved over to Overhauser and cesium design simply because of the improvements in the design, size, energy requirement, and the period of time it takes to run these type of scans.
Usually the puzzle words that could attract a potential listener is treasure hunter, whatsoever. And you definitely saw guys with some kind of metal scanning devices on the beach and trying to find what people lost. But then when you go just 2-3 feet deep into the water, the dust becomes completely problematic. So one way forward is magnetic induction tomography. And that is a part of atomic magnetometers that detect underwater objects. And that could make a guy rich in no time. Let me jump. So, magnetic induction tomography, which we're now getting into the tomography, was originally developed for industrial monitoring. Quickly, it was found in other areas. So it uses oscillating primary magnetic field to induce electric currents in the target objects that in turn produce secondary magnetic fields. By detecting those secondary fields, one can in principle characterize any object that is an electrical conductor as long as the object sensors and primary source is sufficiently close to the other. And that is actually a good moment for the a simple thing that could be simply dropped at the bottom of the sea in not really great depth, but it could be a great depth too. And simply drag with the boat. So, although I don't think that so many guys know about and use it, but it could have a array of cameras, which is not a big deal. When you have a rope, that rope could be actually a fiber optic in it, or if you don't want to have a fiber optic, you could have a Cat6 cable and a simple multiplier. Well, not a multiplier, multi-connection server next to that probe and number of cameras, so you could not only see, feel, but also so sense. Let me jump. So when I was looking at the guys using handheld metal detectors, I was kind of laughing how how uncomplicated methods they use. We have so many things all around, and I was touching most of them. Using a proton as a medium that could be used. But actually, you could explain, because I assume people don't know what we're talking about. If you could explain how that proton magnetometer work with your much better English than mine, it could be interesting. Get to it.
Unfortunately, I don't think precession is one of those wonderful things that you could really explain verbally. You know, it's another one of those things that if you show someone an object precessing, they get it kind of immediately. But if you start talking about it's a wobble introduced in a spinning object, some people might get it, most people won't. But that's the basis of all nuclear magnetic resonance imaging, is to use magnetic fields and RF to induce precessions on magnetic nuclei, and be able to figure by the what's in the nuclei, the frequency and the magnetic field that changes the precession. But discussing how the guts of nuclear magnetic resonance work is a kind of a complicated thing. I've never heard anyone try it on the radio, really.
Well, Dr. Roy, I don't want to compliment you, but you're underestimating yourself, or just doing it on purpose. I'm really amazed about so many things that you could do, but that's me. You know me already. I'm straightforward sometimes. Let me jump. Okay. So the next series of emails that I sent you was acoustic microscopy. And that is interesting, creating pictures based on sound. We're not talking about just scanning the belly of the female, but we're talking about many different things that people don't know about it. You could say a few words about it.
Okay, unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to look at the acoustic microscopy article. Well, a number of articles. Let's see, how many of them are there? There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. That's a lot of YouTubes, Wesley.
Yeah, you're right. Acoustic microscopy is a microscopy that employs very high frequency ultrasound. So we might say that it has some similarity to the typical known to us application of ultrasound. Acoustic microscopes operate non-destructively and penetrate more solid materials to make visible images of internal features, including defects, cracks, delamination, and voids. Although when I was with Federal Highway Administration Department of Transportation, Virginia, and we were asked to find the rigidity of the column supporting the bridges, and they were having cracks. Although we didn't use the ultrasound, but we used the sound. In other words, the technology was not really sending anything. There was a constant presence of vibrations on the bridge, and we put a piezoelectric foil on it, and we were able to create a picture based on those vibrations. So those vibrations were the vibrations of the structure, and we could convert it to sound, it would be one of the frequencies between 0 to 20 kilohertz that would be related to the sound. And we had beautiful, perfect pictures of the cracks to the depth of 2-3 meters, so we're talking about 1 meter, 3 feet, so we're talking about 6 to 8 feet depth, and we could see across the concrete slab and see all of the cracks in it. So practically, we could say that acoustic microscopy is a very much similar to that. It is now used to describe most of the products that acquire and display magnified images of the interaction between the focus beam of acoustic energy on the materials. There is a number of purchases of that acoustic microscope technology in electronic industry. That is used for electronic parking and die attachment, and they have ultrasonic inspection of manufactured products, including aircraft and aircraft engines and locomotives. Do you remember the old time when the turbines of the jet engine, they have a propeller, were almost manually screened with some sort of the sound using devices for the cracks? Do you recall ever such technologies?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard documentaries that kind of pass over that slightly when they're talking about the precision necessary. It's an interesting imaging technology. I think it's kind of taken off in the last 20, 30 years, apparently, up until then. It was kind of written up back in the 30s and 20s, but they couldn't for the life of them come up with a proper technology to generate them. So it seems to be a good technology for looking at structures for floors. Also, I understand that they're considering using it for art detection, because they can actually somewhat peel away the layers. They use other imaging technologies to do it as well, but it's apparently going to be a new method of being able to evaluate the classic paintings of the past.
Yes, that is yet another application of sound, but it is not destructive, although it might be damaging to some art that was painted over. There are rare examples when you have an art that was painted over, but it was painted over in old times, so you have two arts, one beneath the other, and now you use ultrasound in a certain power of, energy, you might actually peel the layer that is not new any longer. But if we're talking about fraudulent activity, yes. That could be a tool, although there is a surface X-ray spectroscopy that is being used for that as well. But coming back to sound. So sound microscopy could be used also in locomotives, marines, turbines, metals, ceramics, polymers, and reinforced composites. I don't know if I pronounce it properly. Composites, is that the proper pronunciation?
Usually it's composite.
Thank you for correcting my English. Composites of those materials. Materials joining processes are also extensively extensively investigated, including welding, solid-state bonding, and adhesive bonding. So a number of active developments and programs, both by manufacturers and end users, for acoustic microscopy, and it's extremely accurate. You have a knife sharp pictures of edges between two different materials in the composite material. So let's say a composite material could be also a